He maneuvered his cumbersome stomach. How much weight had he gained in the last month? Into a chair and glanced at their badges. "Does the name Mick Runyon ring a bell?" one asked. It did, but he wasn't ready to admit anything.
"Maybe."
"Meth dealer. You represented him 3 years ago in federal court. Pled to 10 years. Cooperated with the government. Real nice boy."
"Oh, that Mick Runyon."
"Yes, that one. Did he pay you a fee?"
"My records are at the office in Natchez."
"Great. We have a warrant for them. Can we meet there tomorrow?"
"Love to."
"Anyway, we're betting that your records don't tell us too much about the fees paid by Mr. Runyon. We have a real good source telling us that he paid you in cash, $20,000, and that this was never reported."
"Do tell."
"And if this is true, then it's a violation of RICO and a few other federal statutes."
"Good old RICO. You boys wouldn't be in business without it."
"What time tomorrow?"
"I was planning on campaigning tomorrow. The election is in 2 weeks.
They looked at this bleary-eyed, wild-haired, hungover beast and found it comical that he was a candidate for the Supreme Court. "We'll be at your office in Natchez at noon tomorrow. If you don't show, then we'll have a warrant for your arrest. That should impress the voters." They marched out of the room and slammed the door behind them. Late that afternoon, Marlin appeared as promised. He ordered coffee, which he didn't touch. Cleet ordered rum and soda and smelled as though it was not the first one of the day.
"Can we agree on 50, Cleet?" Marlin asked after a long spell of gazing at the cocktail waitresses scurrying about.
"I'm still thinking."
"Were those two fibbies nice to you this morning?"
Cleet absorbed this without a flinch, without the slightest twitch to indicate his surprise. In fact, he wasn't surprised at all.
"Nice boys," he said. "The way I figure it, Senator Rudd is meddling again. He wants Fisk to win because they're from the same tribe. Of course, we know that Rudd is the uncle of the U.S. attorney down here, a real imbecile who got the job only because of his connections. Damn sure couldn't find a job anywhere else. Rudd leans on his nephew, who brings in the FBI to twist my arm. I drop out while singing the praises of Ron Fisk, and he squeaks out a great victory. He's happy, Rudd's happy, big business is happy. Ain't life grand?"
"You're very close," Marlin said. "And you also took a $20,000 cash fee from a drug dealer and didn't report it. Pretty stupid, but not the end of the world. Nothing that can't be fixed by the senator. You play along now, take your cash, bow out gracefully, and you'll never hear from the fibbies again. Case closed." Cleet's red eyes settled on Marlin's blue ones.
"You swear?"
"I swear. We shake hands now. You can forget the meeting at noon tomorrow in Natchez."
"Where's the money?"
"Outside, to the right. Same green Mustang."
Marlin gently laid his keys on the bar. Cleet grabbed them and disappeared. Chapter 29. With only 15 days left before the election, Barry Reinhardt was invited to dinner at the Vietnamese Hole in the Wall on Bleecker Street. Mr. Trudeau wanted an update. On the flight from Boca, Barry gloated over his latest poll. Fisk was 16 points ahead, a lead that could not be lost. The gay marriage issue had bumped him 4 points. The gun attacks on McCarthy added 3 more. Cleet Coley's rather lame farewell added another 3. The campaign itself was running smoothly. Ron Fisk was a workhorse who did exactly what Tony Zachary told him to do. There was plenty of money. Their television ads were hitting all markets with perfect regularity. The responses from their direct mail were nothing short of astonishing. The campaign had raised $320,000 from small donors who were upset about gays and guns. McCarthy was running hard to catch up and falling further behind. Mr. Trudeau looked lean and tanned, and he was thrilled with the latest summaries. The 16-point lead dominated the dinner conversation. Carl quizzed Reinhardt relentlessly about the numbers. Could they be trusted? How were they arrived at? How did they compare with Barry's other races? What would it take to blow the lead? Had Barry ever seen such a big lead evaporate? Barry all but guaranteed a win. For the first three quarters of the year, Crane Chemical reported dismal sales and weak earnings. The company was racked with production problems in Texas and Indonesia. Three plants shut down for major unscheduled repairs. A plant in Brazil closed for undisclosed reasons, leaving its 2,000 employees out of work. Huge orders were unfilled. Longtime customers left in frustration. The sales force could not get product. Competitors cut prices and poached business. Morale was down, and there were rumors of major cutbacks and layoffs. Behind the chaos, Carl Trudeau was skillfully pulling all the strings. He did nothing illegal, but cooking the books was an art he had mastered many years ago. When one of his companies needed bad numbers, Carl could deliver them. During the year, Crane wrote off huge chunks of research and development, shifted unusually large sums of money into legal reserves, borrowed heavily on its credit lines, stifled sales by sabotaging production, bloated expenses, sold two profitable divisions, and managed to alienate many of its customers. Through it all, Carl coordinated enough leaks to float a printing press. Since the verdict, Crane had been on the radar of business reporters, and all bad news got plenty of ink. Of course, every story referred to the massive legal problems the company was facing. The possibility of bankruptcy had been mentioned several times after careful plants by Carl. The stock began the year at $17. 9 months later, it was $12.50. With the election just 2 weeks away, Carl was ready for one last assault on the battered common shares of Crane Chemical Corporation. The phone call from Jared Curtin seemed like a dream. Wes listened to the words and closed his eyes. It could not be true. Curtin explained that he had been instructed by his client to explore the possibilities of settling the Bowmore litigation. Crane Chemical was a mess, and until the lawsuits went away, it could not regain its focus and compete effectively. His proposal was to gather all the attorneys in one room at one time and start the process. It would be complicated because there were so many plaintiffs with so many issues. It would be difficult because there were so many lawyers to control. He insisted that Wes and Mary Grace act as lead counsel for the plaintiff's lawyers, but they could work out those details at the first meeting. Time was suddenly crucial. Curtin had already reserved a convention room at a hotel in Hattiesburg, and he wanted the meeting to begin on Friday and run through the weekend, if necessary. "Today is Tuesday," Wes said, gripping the phone with white knuckles. "Yes, I know. As I said, my client is anxious to begin this process. It could take weeks or months to complete, but we're ready to sit down." Wes was ready, too. He had a deposition set for Friday, something that was easily postponed. "What are the rules?" he asked. Curtin had the benefit of hours of planning. Wes was reacting out of shock and excitement. Plus, Curtin had been around the block a few more times than Wes. He had negotiated mass settlements on several occasions. Wes could only dream of one. "I'm sending a letter to all known plaintiffs' attorneys," Curtin said. "Look over the list and see if I'm missing anyone. As you know, they're still popping up. All lawyers are invited, but the easiest way to screw up a settlement conference like this is to give the trial lawyers the microphones. You and Mary Grace will talk for the plaintiffs. I'll talk for Crane. The first challenge is to identify all persons who are making any sort of claim. Our records show about 600, and these range from dead bodies to nosebleeds. In my letters, I'm asking the lawyers to submit the names of clients, whether they have filed suit or not. Once we know who expects a piece of the pie, the next challenge will be to classify the claims. Unlike some mass tort settlements with 10,000 plaintiffs, this one will be manageable
in that we can talk about individual claims. Our current numbers show 68 dead, 143 wounded and probably dying, and the rest with various afflictions that in all probability are not life-threatening. Curtin ticked off the numbers like a war correspondent reporting from battle. Wes couldn't help but grimace, nor could he suppress another vile thought about Crane Chemical. Anyway, we'll start the process of going through these numbers. The goal is to arrive at one figure, then compare it with the cash my client is willing to spend. And what might that number be? Wes asked with a desperate laugh. Not now, Wes. Maybe later. I'm asking each lawyer to fill out a standardized form for each client. If we can get these back before Friday, we'll have a head start. I'm bringing a full team, Wes. My litigators, support staff, experts, number crunchers, and I'll even have a guy with some spine from Crane. Plus, of course, the usual crew from the insurance companies. You might want to reserve a large room for your support people.
Reserve with what? Wes almost asked. Surely Curtin knew about the bankruptcy.
Good idea, he said. And Wes, my client is really concerned about secrecy. There is no reason for this to be publicized. If word gets out, then the plaintiffs and their lawyers and the whole town of Bowmore will get excited. What happens then if the negotiations go nowhere? Let's keep a lid on this.
Sure. How ridiculous. Curtin was about to send his letter to no fewer than 20 law firms.
Babe at the coffee shop in Bowmore would know about the settlement conference before she began serving lunch.
The following morning, the Wall Street Journal ran a front-page story about Crane Chemical's settlement overtures. An anonymous source who worked for the company confirmed the truth of the rumors. Experts chimed in with varying opinions, but it was generally regarded as a positive step for the company. Large settlements can be calculated. Liabilities can be contained. Wall Street understands hard numbers, and it hates unpredictability. There is a long history of battered companies shoring up their financial futures with massive settlements that, while costly, were effective in cleaning up litigation. Crane opened at $12.75 and advanced $2.75 in heavy trading. By mid-afternoon Wednesday, the phones were ringing nonstop at Peyton & Peyton and many other law firms as well. Word of a settlement was out there, on the street and flying around the internet. Denny Ott called and talked to Mary Grace. A group of Pine Grove residents had gathered at the church to offer prayers, exchange gossip, and wait for a miracle. It was like a vigil, he said. Not surprisingly, there were different versions of the truth. A settlement had already been negotiated, and money was on the way. No, the settlement would take place on Friday, but there was no doubt that it would happen. No, there was no settlement at all, just a meeting of the lawyers. Mary Grace explained what was happening and asked Denny to pass along the truth. It quickly became apparent that either she or Wes would need to hustle over to the church and meet with their clients. Babe's was packed with spirited coffee drinkers, all looking for the latest word. Would Crane be required to clean up its toxic dump? Someone claiming authority answered yes. That would be a condition of the settlement. How much would the death claims be worth? Someone else had heard the figure of $5 million each. Arguments raged. Experts rose up and were soon shouted down. F. Clyde Hardin walked over from his law office and immediately took center stage. His class action had been ridiculed by many of the locals, who felt he was just riding the Peyton's coattails with a bunch of opportunistic clients. He and his good pal Sterling Bentz from Philadelphia were claiming almost 300 severely and permanently injured members of their class action. Since its filing in January, it had gone nowhere. Now, however, F. Clyde had instantly gained stature. Any settlement had to include his people. He would have a seat at the table on Friday, he explained to the silent crowd. He would be sitting there alongside Wes and Mary Grace Peyton. Jeanette Baker was behind the counter of a convenience store at the south edge of Bowmore, when she received a call from Mary Grace. Do not get excited, her lawyer warned rather sternly. This could be a lengthy process, and the possibility of a settlement is remote. Jeanette had questions, but did not know where to begin. Mary Grace would be at the Pine Grove Church at 7 p.m. for a full discussion with all of her clients. Jeanette promised to be there. With a $41 million verdict attached to it, Jeanette Baker's case would be the first one on the table. The settlement news was too much for Beaumore to handle. In the small offices downtown, the secretaries and realtors and insurance agents talked of nothing else. The languid human commerce along Main Street stopped dead as friends and neighbors found it impossible to pass one another without comparing gossip. The clerks in the Cary County Courthouse collected rumors, amended them, embellished some, and reduced some, then passed them along. In the schools, the teachers gathered in their coffee rooms and exchanged the latest news. Pine Grove wasn't the only church where the faithful and the hopeful met for prayer and counseling. Many of the town's pastors spent the afternoon on the phone listening to the victims of Crane Chemical. A settlement would close the town's ugliest chapter and allow it to begin again. The infusion of money would compensate those who had suffered. The cash would be spent and respent and boost the dying economy. Crane would certainly be required to clean up its pollution, and once it was finally gone, perhaps the water would become safe again. Beaumore with clean water. A dream almost impossible to believe. The community could finally shake off the nickname Cancer County. A settlement was a fast and final end to the nightmare. No one in the town wanted litigation that would be prolonged and ugly. No one wanted another trial like Jeanette Baker's. Nat Lester had been pestering newspaper editors and reporters for a month. He was furious at the misleading advertising that had drenched South Mississippi, and even angrier at the editors for not railing against it. He put together a report in which he took the Fisk ads, print, direct mail, radio, internet, and television, and dissected them, pointing out every lie, half-truth, and manipulated word. He also estimated, based on direct mail media buys, the amount of cash that was pouring into the Fisk campaign. His figure was at least $3 million, and he predicted that the vast majority was coming from out of state. There was no way to verify this until after the election. His report was emailed and sent overnight to every newspaper in the district, then followed up with aggressive phone calls. He updated it every day, then resent it and grew even more obnoxious on the phone. It finally paid off. To his amazement and great satisfaction, the three largest papers in the district informed him, separately and off the record, of course, that they planned to run stinging editorials on the Fisk campaign in the upcoming Sunday editions. And Nat's luck continued. The same-sex marriage issue caught the attention of the New York Times, and a reporter arrived in Jackson to poke around. His name was Gilbert, and he soon made his way to the McCarthy campaign office, where Nat gave him an earful off the record. He also gave Gilbert the phone numbers of the two gay law students who were stalking Meyerchek and Spano. Speaking off the record, they told Gilbert everything and showed him their file. They had spent 4 days in Chicago and learned a lot. They met Meyerchek in his bar near Evanston, told him they were new to the city and looking for friends. They spent hours in the place, got roaring drunk with the regulars, and never once heard anyone mention anything about a lawsuit in Mississippi. In the photos in the Jackson paper, Meyerchek had blonde hair and funky eyeglasses. In Chicago, the hair was darker and there was no eyewear. His smiling face was in one of the group photos they had taken at the bar. As for Spano, they visited the design center where he worked as a consultant for lower-end home buyers. They pretended to be new residents in an old building nearby, and they spent 2 hours with him. Noticing their accents, Spano at one point asked them where they were from. When they answered Jackson, Mississippi, he had no reaction to the place. "Ever been there?" one of them asked. "I've passed through a couple of times," Spano said. This from a registered voter, a licensed driver, and a current appellant before the state's Supreme Court. Though Spano was never seen at Meyerchek's bar, it appeared as if the two men were indeed a couple. They shared the same address, a bungalow on Clark Street. The law students had continued to call and visit the near-empty apartment in Jackson with no response. 41 days earlier, while knocking on the door, they stuck a piece of junk mail into a small gap near the doorknob. It was still there. The door had not been opened. The old Saab had not been moved. One tire was flat. Gilbert became captivated by the story and pursued it doggedly. The attempt to get married in Mississippi smelled like a cynical ploy to thrust the same-sex marriage issue to the forefront of the McCarthy-Fisk race. And only McCarthy was getting hurt. Gilbert badgered the radical lawyer who represented Meyerchek and Spano, but got nowhere. He dogged Tony Zachary for 2 days, but couldn't get a word. His phone calls to Ron Fisk and his campaign headquarters went unanswered. He spoke to both Meyerchek and Spano by phone, but was quickly cut off when he pressed them on their ties to Mississippi. He gathered a few choice quotes from Nat Lester, and he verified the facts dug up by the law students. Gilbert finished his report and sent it in. Chapter 30. The first fight was over the question of who would be allowed in the room. On the defense side, Jared Curtin had full command of his battalion, and there were no problems. The brawl was on the other side. Sterling Bentz arrived early and loudly, with an entourage that included young men who appeared to be lawyers and others who appeared to be leg breakers. He claimed to represent over half of the Beaumont victims and therefore deserved a lead role in the negotiations. He spoke with a clipped nasal voice and in an accent quite foreign to South Mississippi, and he was instantly despised by everyone there. Wes settled him down, but only for a moment. F. Clyde Hardin watched from the safety of a corner, crunching a biscuit, enjoying the argument, and praying for a quick settlement. The IRS was now sending registered letters. A national toxic tort star from Melbourne Beach, Florida, arrived with his support staff and joined in the debate. He too claimed to represent hundreds of injured people, and since he was a veteran of mass tort settlement, he figured he should handle things from the plaintiff's side. The two class action lawyers were soon bickering over stolen clients. There were 17 other law firms jockeying for position. A few were reputable personal injury firms, but most were small-town car wreck lawyers who had picked up a case or two while sniffing around Beaumont. Tensions were high hours before the meeting began, and once the yelling started, there was the real possibility of a punch being thrown. When the voices were sharpest, Jared Curtin calmly got their attention and announced that Wes and Mary Grace Payton would decide who sat where. If anyone had a problem with that, then he and his client and its insurance company would walk out the door with all the money. This calmed things down. Then there was the issue of the press. At least three reporters were on hand to cover this secret meeting, and when asked to leave, they were quite reluctant. Fortunately, Curtin had arranged for some armed security. The reporters were eventually escorted out of the hotel. Curtin had also suggested and offered to pay for a referee, a disinterested person well-versed in litigation and settlements. Wes had agreed, and Curtin found a retired federal judge in Fort Worth who worked part-time as a mediator. Judge Rosenthal quietly assumed control after the trial lawyers had settled down. It took him an hour to negotiate the seating. He would have the chair at the end of the long table. To his right, halfway down and in the center, would be Mr. Curtin, flanked by his partners, associates, Frank Sully from Hattiesburg, two suits from Crane, and one from its liability insurance carrier. A total of 11 at the table for the defense, with another 20 packed behind them. To his left, the Paytons sat in the center, opposite Jared Curtin. They were flanked by Jim McMay, the Hattiesburg trial lawyer with four death cases out of Bowmore. McMay had made a fortune on the Fen-Phen diet pill litigation and had participated in several mass settlement conferences. He was joined by a lawyer from Gulfport who had similar experience. The other chairs were taken by Mississippi lawyers who had legitimate cases from Bowmore. The class action boys were shoved into the background. Sterling Bentz voiced his objection to his placement in the room, and Wes angrily told him to shut up. When the leg breakers reacted badly, Jared Curtin announced that the class actions were the lowest priority on Crane's list, and if he, Bentz, hoped to collect a dime, then he should keep quiet and stay out of the way.
"This ain't Philadelphia," Judge Rosenthal said. "Are those bodyguards or lawyers?"
"Both," Bentz snapped back.
"Keep them under control."
Bentz sat down, mumbling and cursing. It was 10 a.m., and Wes was already exhausted. His wife, though, was ready to begin. For 3 hours nonstop, they shuffled papers. Judge Rosenthal directed traffic as client summaries were produced, copied next door, reviewed, then classified according to the judge's arbitrary rating system. Death was class one. Confirmed cancer was class two. All others were class three. A stalemate occurred when Mary Grace suggested that Jeanette Baker be given first priority and thus more money because she had actually gone to trial. "Why is her case worth more than the other death cases?" a trial lawyer asked.
"Because she went to trial?" Mary Grace shot back with a hard gaze.
In other words, Baker's lawyers had the guts to take on Crane, while the other lawyers chose to sit back and watch. In the months before the trial, the Paytons had approached at least five of the other trial lawyers present, including Jim McMay, and practically begged them for help. All declined.
"We will concede that the Baker case is worth more," Jared Curtin said. "Frankly, I'm unable to ignore a $41 million verdict."
And for the first time in years, Mary Grace actually smiled at the man. She could have hugged him. At one, they broke for a two-hour lunch. The Paytons and Jim McMay hid away in a corner of the hotel restaurant and tried to analyze the meeting so far. Going in, they were consumed with the question of Crane's intent. Was it serious about a settlement? Or was it a stunt to push along the company's agenda? The fact that the national business papers knew so much about the secret settlement talks made the lawyers suspicious. But so far, Mr. Curtin had given every indication that he was a man on a mission. There had been no smiles from the Crane suits or the insurance boys, perhaps a sign that they were about to part with their money. At 3 p.m. in New York, Carl Trudeau leaked the word that the negotiations were progressing nicely down in Mississippi. Crane was optimistic about a settlement. Its stock closed the week at $16.50, up $4. At 3 p.m. in Hattiesburg, the negotiators reassumed their positions, and Judge Rosenthal started the paper mill again. 3 hours later, the initial accounting was complete. On the table were the claims of 704 people. 68 had died of cancer and were blaming Crane. 143 were now suffering from cancer. The rest had a wide range of lesser illnesses and afflictions that were allegedly caused by the contaminated drinking water from the Bowmore pumping station. Judge Rosenthal congratulated both sides on a hard and productive day and adjourned the meeting until 9 o'clock Saturday morning. Wes and Mary Grace drove straight to the office and reported to the firm. Sherman had been in the negotiating room all day and shared his observations.
They agreed that Jared Curtin had returned to Hattiesburg with the goal of settling the Bowmore litigation and that his client seemed committed to that end. Wes cautioned that it was much too early to celebrate. They had managed only to identify the parties. The first dollar was nowhere near the table. Mac and Liza begged them to go to the movies. Halfway through the 8 o'clock show, Wes began to nod off. Mary Grace stared blankly at the screen, munching on popcorn and mentally crunching numbers related to medical expenses, pain and suffering, loss of companionship, loss of wages, loss of everything. She did not dare entertain the thoughts of calculating attorney's fees. There were fewer suits and ties at the table Saturday morning. Even Judge Rosenthal looked quite casual in a black polo shirt under a sport coat. When the restless lawyers were in place and things were quiet, he said with a great old voice that must have dominated many trials, "I suggest we start with the death cases and walk through them all." No two death cases were the same from a settlement standpoint. Children were worth much less than adults because they have no record of earning power. Young fathers were worth more because of the loss of future wages. Some of the dead folks suffered for years, others went quickly. Everyone had a different figure for medical bills. Judge Rosenthal presented another scale, arbitrary but at least a starting point, in which each case would be rated based on its value. The highest cases would get a 5, and the cheapest, children, would get a 1. Time out was called several times as the plaintiff's lawyers haggled over this. When it was finally agreed upon, they began with Jeanette Baker. She was given a 10. The next case involved a 54-year-old woman who worked part-time in a bakery and died after a 3-year battle with leukemia. She was given a 3. As they plowed through the list, each lawyer was allowed to present his particular case and plead for a higher rating. Through it all, there was no indication from Jared Curtin of how much he was willing to pay for any of the death cases. Mary Grace watched him carefully when the other lawyers were talking. His face and actions revealed nothing but deep concentration. At 2:30, they finished with Class 1 and moved to the longer list of those claimants who were still alive but battling cancer. Rating their cases was trickier. No one could know how long each would survive or how much each would suffer. No one could predict the likelihood of death. The lucky ones would live and become cancer-free. The discussion disintegrated into several heated arguments, and at times Judge Rosenthal was flustered and unable to suggest a compromise. Late in the day, Jared Curtin began to show signs of strain and frustration. As 7 p.m. approached and the session was mercifully winding down, Sterling Bentz could not restrain himself. "I'm not sure how much longer I can sit here and watch this little exercise," he announced rudely as he approached the table at the far end, away from Judge Rosenthal. "I mean, I've been here for 2 days, and I haven't been allowed to speak, which of course means my clients have been ignored. Enough is enough. I represent a class action of over 300 injured people, and you all seem determined to screw them." Wes started a rebuke but thought better of it. Let him ramble. They were about to adjourn anyway. "My clients are not going to be ignored," he practically shouted, and everyone grew still. There was a hint of madness in his voice, and certainly in his eyes, and perhaps it was best to let him rant a little. "My clients have suffered greatly and are still suffering, and you people are not concerned with them. I can't hang around here forever. I'm due in San Francisco tomorrow afternoon for another settlement. I got 8,000 cases against Schmelzer for their laxative pills. So since everyone here seems quite content to chat about everything but money, let me tell you where I am." He had their attention. Jared Curtin and the money boys perked up and stiffened a bit. Mary Grace watched every wrinkle in Curtin's face. If this nut was about to throw a figure on the table, she wanted her adversary's reaction. "I'm not settling my cases for less than $100,000 each," Bent said with a sneer. Maybe more, depending on each client.
Curtin's face was frozen, but then it usually was. One of his associates shook his head. Another one smiled a silly smile of amusement. The two Crane executives frowned and shifted as they dismissed this as absurd. As the notion of $30 million floated around the room, Wes did the simple math. Bence would probably take a third, throw a few crumbs at F. Clyde Hardin, then quickly move on to the next mass tort bonanza. F. Clyde was cowering in a far corner, the same spot he'd occupied for many hours now. The paper cup in his hand was filled with orange juice, crushed ice, and 4 ounces of vodka. It was, after all, almost 7 p.m. on a Saturday. The math was so simple he could do it in his sleep. His cut was 5% of the total fees, or $500,000, under the rather reasonable scheme being so boldly suggested by his co-counsel. Their arrangement also paid F. Clyde $500 per client, and with 300 clients, he should have already received $150,000. He had not. Bence had passed along about a third of that, but seemed disinclined to discuss the rest. He was a very busy lawyer and hard to get on the phone. Surely he would come through as promised. F. Clyde gulped his drink as Bence's declaration rattled around the room. Bence continued.
We're not taking peanuts and going home, he threatened. At some point in these negotiations, and the sooner the better, I want my clients' cases on the table.
Tomorrow morning at 9, Judge Rosenthal suddenly barked. As for now, we are adjourned.
A Pathetic Campaign was the title of the lead editorial in Sunday's Clarion Ledger out of Jackson. Using a page out of Nat Lester's report, the editors damned the Ron Fisk campaign for its sleazy advertising. They accused Fisk of taking millions from big business and using it to mislead the public. His ads were filled with half-truths and statements taken wholly out of context. Fear was his weapon. Fear of homosexuals, fear of gun control, fear of sexual predators. He was condemned for labeling Sheila McCarthy a liberal, when in fact her body of work, which the editors had studied, could only be considered quite moderate. They blasted Fisk for promising to vote this way or that on cases he had yet to review as a member of the court. The editorial also decried the entire process. So much money was being raised and spent by both candidates that fair and unbiased decision-making was in jeopardy. How could Sheila McCarthy, who had so far received over $1.5 million from trial lawyers, be expected to ignore this money when those same lawyers appeared before the Supreme Court? It finished with a call to abolish judicial elections and have the judges appointed based on merit by a nonpartisan panel. The Sun-Herald of Biloxi was even nastier. It accused the Fisk campaign of outright deceit and used the Darrell Sackett mailing as its prime example. Sackett was dead, not loose and on the prowl. He had been dead for 4 years, something Nat Lester had learned with a couple of quick phone calls. The Hattiesburg American challenged the Fisk campaign to retract its negative and misleading ads and to disclose before Election Day its contributions from big donors outside the state. It urged both candidates to clean up the race and honor the dignity of the Supreme Court. On page 3 of Section A of the New York Times, Gilbert's expose ran with photos of Meyercheck and Spano, as well as Fisk and McCarthy. It covered the race in general, then focused on the gay marriage issue created and injected into the race by the two men from Illinois. Gilbert did a thorough job of accumulating evidence that the two men were longtime residents of Chicago and had virtually no ties to Mississippi. He did not speculate that they were being used by conservative political operatives to sabotage McCarthy. He didn't have to. The punchline was delivered in the final paragraph.
Nat Lester was quoted as saying, "These guys are a couple of stooges being used by Ron Fisk and his backers to create an issue that does not exist. Their goal is to fire up the right-wing Christians and march them down to the polls."
Ron and Doreen Fisk were at the kitchen table, ignoring their early coffee, rereading the Jackson editorial, and fuming. The campaign had gone so smoothly. They were ahead in all the polls, 9 days to go, and they could see the victory. Why, then, was Ron suddenly being described as deceitful and dishonest by the state's largest newspaper? It was a painful, humiliating slap, one that they had no idea was coming, and it was certainly not deserved. They were honest, upstanding, clean-cut Christian people. Why this? The phone rang, and Ron grabbed it. Tony's tired voice said,
"Have you seen the Jackson paper?"
"Yes, we're looking at it now."
"Have you seen the one from Hattiesburg and the Sun-Herald?"
"No, why?"
"Do you read the New York Times?"
"No."
"Check them out online. Call me in an hour."
"Is it bad?"
"Yes."
They read and fumed for another hour, then decided to skip church. Ron felt betrayed and embarrassed and was in no mood to leave the house. According to the latest numbers from his pollster in Atlanta, he had a comfortable lead. Now, though, he felt defeat was certain. No candidate could survive such a thrashing. He blamed the liberal press, he blamed Tony Zachary and those who controlled the campaign, and he blamed himself for being so naive. Why did he place so much trust in people he barely knew? Doreen assured him it was not his fault. He had thrown himself so completely into the campaigning that he had had little time to watch everything else. Any campaign is chaotic. No one can monitor the actions of all the workers and volunteers. Ron unloaded on Tony during a lengthy and tense phone conversation. "You've embarrassed me," Ron said. "You've humiliated me and my family to the point that I really don't want to leave the house. I'm thinking about quitting."
"You can't quit, Ron. You have too much invested," Tony replied, trying to control his panic and reassure his boy.
"That's the problem, Tony. I've allowed you guys to generate too much cash, and you cannot handle it. Stop all television ads right now."
"That's impossible, Ron. They're already in the pipeline."
"So I'm not in control of my own campaign. Is that what you're telling me, Tony?"
"It's not that simple."
"I'm not leaving the house, Tony. Pull all the ads right now. Stop everything. And I'm calling the editors of these newspapers. I'm admitting my mistakes."
"Ron, come on."
"I'm the boss, Tony. It's my campaign."
"Yes, and you've got the race won. Don't screw it up with only 9 days to go."
"Did you know that Darryl Sackett was dead?"
"Well, I really can't."
"Answer the question, Tony. Did you know he was dead?"
"I'm not sure."
"You knew he was dead, and you deliberately ran a false ad, didn't you?"
"No,
you're fired, Tony. You're fired, and I quit."
"Don't overreact, Ron. Settle down."
"You're fired."
"I'll be down in an hour."
"You do that, Tony. You get down here as quick as possible, and until then, you're fired."
"I'm leaving now. Don't do anything until I get there."
"I'm calling the editors right now."
"Don't do that, Ron. Please. Wait until I get there."
The lawyers had little time for newspapers on Sunday morning. By 8 o'clock, they were gathering at the hotel for what would surely be the most important day yet. There had been no indication from Jared Curtin as to how long he might negotiate before heading back to Atlanta, but it was assumed that round one would be over on Sunday afternoon. Other than the $30 million suggestion made by Sterling Bentz the evening before, there had been no talk of money. That had to change on Sunday. Wes and Mary Grace were determined to leave that day with a general idea of how much the Class 1 and Class 2 cases were worth. By 8:30, all the plaintiffs' lawyers were in place, most of them huddled in serious conversations, all of them ignoring Sterling Bentz, who in turn ignored them. His entourage was still intact. He was not speaking to the other class action lawyer from Melbourne Beach. Judge Rosenthal arrived at 8:45 and commented on the absence of everyone on the defense side. The trial lawyers finally noticed this. There was not a soul sitting opposite them. Wes punched in the number of Jared Curtin's cell phone, but listened to his recording.
"We did agree on 9 a.m., didn't we?"
asked Rosenthal, 5 minutes before the hour. It was unanimously agreed that 9 was the magic hour. They waited, and time suddenly moved much slower. At 9:02, Frank Sully, local counsel for Crane, walked into the room and said, somewhat sheepishly, almost in embarrassment, "My client has decided to recess these negotiations until further notice. I'm very sorry for the inconvenience." "Where's Jared Curtin?" Judge Rosenthal demanded. "He's flying back to Atlanta right now."
"When did your client make this decision?"
"I don't know. I was informed about an hour ago. I'm very sorry, Judge. I apologize to everyone here." The room seemed to tilt as one side sank under the weight of this sudden turn of events. Lawyers, giddy in anticipation of finally slicing up the pie, dropped their pens and pencils and gaped at one another in shock. Great gasps of air were discharged. Curses were mumbled just loud enough to be heard. Shoulders sagged. They wanted to throw something at Sully, but he was just the local, and they had learned a long time ago that he had no clout. F. Clyde Hardin wiped sweat from his wet face and tried valiantly not to throw up. There was a sudden rush to leave, to clear out. It was maddening to sit there and stare at the empty chairs, chairs once occupied by men who just might have made them rich. The trial lawyers quickly gathered stacks of papers, restuffed their briefcases, and offered brusque goodbyes. Wes and Mary Grace said nothing as they drove to their apartment. Chapter 31. Monday morning, the Wall Street Journal broke the news of the collapse of the settlement negotiations down in Hattiesburg. The story on page 2 was written by a reporter with some very good sources inside Crane Chemical, one of whom blamed the plaintiff's lawyers. "Their demands were just too unrealistic. We went in good faith and got nowhere." Another anonymous source said, "It's hopeless. Because of the verdict, every trial lawyer thinks his case is worth $40 million. Mr. Watts, Crane's CEO, said, "We are very disappointed. We wanted to get this litigation behind us and move on. Now our future is quite uncertain." Carl Trudeau read the story online at 4:30 in the morning in his penthouse. He laughed and rubbed his hands together in anticipation of a very profitable week. Wes called Jared Curtin throughout the morning, but the great man was traveling and could not be reached. His cell phone was stuck on voicemail. His secretary eventually became rude, but then so was Wes. He and Mary Grace seriously doubted if the wild demands by Sterling Bence had frightened Crane away. In relative terms, his suggestion of $30 million would be a fraction of any workable settlement. When the news finally arrived in Beaumont, it was received like another plague. At the McCarthy headquarters, Nat Lester had worked through the night and was still wired when Sheila arrived at 8:30, her usual time. He had emailed the Times story to every newspaper in the district and was calling reporters and editors when she walked in with a well-rested smile and asked for a pineapple juice.
"We've got these clowns on the run," he announced jubilantly. "Their dirty tricks have caught up with them."
"Congratulations. It's beautiful."
"We're sending the editorials and the Times story to every registered voter."
"How much does that cost?"
"Who cares? With a week to go, we can't pinch pennies. Are you ready?"
"I leave in an hour." The next 7 days would take her to 34 stops in 20 counties, all made possible by the use of a King Air on loan from one trial lawyer and a small jet from another. The blitz had been coordinated by Nat
and would take place with the help of school teachers, labor bosses, black leaders, and of course, trial lawyers. She would not return to Jackson until after the election. While she was on the stump, her last round of television ads would flood the district. By the time the votes were counted, her campaign would not have one dime. She was praying that it would not be in debt. Ron Fisk finally left the house on Monday morning, but he did not make his usual trip to the office. Instead, he and Doreen drove to Jackson, to the offices of Judicial Vision, for another long and stressful meeting with Tony Zachary. They had slugged their way through a four-hour ordeal on Sunday afternoon in the den of the Fisk home, and they had resolved little. Ron was suspending all campaign activities until he could repair his good name. He had fired Tony at least four times, but they were still talking. Throughout the day and into Sunday night, Tedford in Atlanta had been polling furiously, and by late Monday morning there were some results. In spite of the barrage of condemnation, Ron Fisk was still 3 points ahead of Sheila McCarthy. The gay marriage issue had captivated the voters, most of whom still favored the more conservative candidate. Ron wasn't sure if he could believe anyone who worked for his campaign, but the new poll did lighten his mood somewhat.
"You've got this thing won, Ron," Tony said again and again. "Don't blow it."
They finally reached an understanding, one that Ron insisted they sign as if they had negotiated a contract. First, Ron would stay in the race. Second, Tony would keep his job as campaign manager. Third, Ron would meet with the newspaper editors, admit his mistakes, and promise a clean race for the remaining 8 days. Fourth, no campaign literature, ads, TV spots, direct mail, radio commercials, nothing would be used until it was first approved by Ron. When they were pals again, they enjoyed a quick lunch at the Capitol Grill. Then Ron and Doreen drove home. They were proud that they had held their ground and anxious to resume the campaign. They could smell the victory. Barry Reinhart arrived in Jackson at noon on Monday and established his base in the largest suite of a downtown hotel. He would not leave Mississippi until after the election. He waited impatiently for Tony to arrive with the news that they still had a horse in the race. For a man who took great pride in staying cool, regardless of the pressure, the past 24 hours had been nerve-wracking. Barry had slept little. If Fisk quit, then Reinhart's career would be severely damaged, if not outright ruined. Tony walked into the suite with a huge smile, and both men were able to laugh. They were soon reviewing their media buys and advertising plans. They had the cash to saturate the district with TV ads, and if Mr. Fisk wanted only positive ones, then so be it. The market's reaction to the settlement news was swift and ugly. Crane opened at $15.25 and by noon was trading at $12.75. Carl Trudeau watched the fall gleefully, his net worth shrinking by the minute. To add to the fear and frenzy, he organized a meeting between the top Crane executives and the company's bankruptcy attorneys, then leaked this news to a reporter. On Tuesday morning, the business section of the New York Times ran a story in which an in-house lawyer for the company said, "We'll probably file for bankruptcy protection this week." For the first time in 20 years, the stock fell through the $10 floor and traded around $9.50. At midday on Tuesday, Meyercheck and Spano arrived in Jackson by private jet. They were picked up by a car with a driver and taken to the office of their attorney, where they met a reporter with the Jackson Clarion Ledger. In a one-hour interview, they rebuked the story by Gilbert, reaffirmed their citizenship in their new state, and talked at length about the importance of their lawsuit now pending before the Mississippi Supreme Court. They held hands throughout the entire interview,
and posed for a photographer from the newspaper. While this was happening, Barry Reinhart and Tony Zachary pored over the findings from their latest poll. Fisk's 16-point lead had been reduced to 5, the most dramatic 72-hour drop Barry had ever seen. But he was too seasoned to panic. Tony, however, was a nervous wreck. They decided to reshuffle the television ads. They discarded the Daryl Sackett attack piece and one showing illegal aliens crossing the border. For the next 3 days, they would stick to gay marriage and the glory of guns. Over the weekend, they would shift to the comfort ads and leave the voters with warm and fuzzy feelings about Ron Fisk and his wholesomeness. Meanwhile, the weary mail carriers in South Mississippi would deliver several tons of Fisk propaganda each day until the campaign was mercifully over. All to be done with Mr. Fisk's approval, of course. Denny Ott finished his letter after several drafts and asked his wife to read it. When she approved, he took it to the post office. It read, "Dear Brother Ted, I have listened to a recording of your sermon last Sunday, broadcast on radio station WBMR, during your worship hour. I hesitate to call it a sermon. It was more along the lines of a stump speech. I'm sure your condemnation of homosexuals is standard fare from your pulpit, and I will not comment on it. However, your attack on liberal judges 9 days before the election was nothing but a diatribe against Sheila McCarthy, who of course was never called by name. By attacking her, you obviously endorsed her opponent. Such political speech is expressly forbidden by law and specifically forbidden by Internal Revenue Service regulations. As a 501c3 nonprofit organization, Harvest Tabernacle cannot engage in political activity. To do so is to risk losing its nonprofit status, a catastrophic event for any church. I have heard from good sources that other local pastors, all members of your Brotherhood Coalition, are involving themselves and their churches in this campaign. I'm sure this is part of a well-coordinated effort to help elect Ron Fisk, and I have no doubt that this Sunday, you and the others will use the pulpit to urge your members to vote for him. Mr. Fisk is being used by a conspiracy of big business interests to stack our Supreme Court with judges who will protect corporate wrongdoers by limiting their liability. Only the little folks will suffer, your people and mine. Be warned that I will be watching and listening this Sunday, and I will not hesitate to notify the Internal Revenue Service if you continue your illegal activities. Yours in Christ, Denny Ott." At noon Thursday, the Peyton Law Firm met for a quick lunch and final review of its last-minute campaigning. On a sheetrock wall in the pit, Sherman had arranged in chronological order the print ads used so far by Ron Fisk. There were 6 full-page solicitations from newspapers and 5 direct mailings. The collection was now being updated daily because the Fisk printing presses were working overtime. It was an impressive and quite depressing lineup. Using a street map of Hattiesburg and a list of registered voters, Sherman assigned neighborhoods near the university. Walking door to door, he would go with Tabby, Rusty with Vicky, Wes with Mary Grace. They had 2,000 doors to cover during the next 5 days. Olivia agreed to stay behind and answer the phone. She was a bit too arthritic to hit the streets. Other teams, many of them from the offices of local trial lawyers, would canvass the rest of Hattiesburg and its outlying suburbs. In addition to handing out McCarthy materials, most of these volunteers would distribute brochures for Judge Thomas Harrison. The prospect of knocking on hundreds of doors was actually quite welcome, at least to Wes and Mary Grace. The mood at the office had been funereal since Monday. The settlement fiasco had drained their spirits.
The constant chatter about Crane filing Chapter 11 frightened them. They were distracted and edgy, and both needed a few days off. The final push was orchestrated by Nat Lester. Every precinct in all 27 counties had someone assigned to it, and Nat had the cell phone number of every volunteer. He started calling them Thursday afternoon, and he would hound them until late Monday night. The letter from Brother Ted was hand-delivered to Pine Grove Church. It read, "Dear Pastor Ott, I'm touched by your concern, and I'm also delighted you have taken an interest in my sermons. Listen to them carefully, and one day you may come to know Jesus Christ as your personal Savior. Until then, I will continue to pray for you and all those you are leading astray. God built our house of worship 14 years ago, then He paid off the mortgage. He led me to the pulpit there, and each week He speaks to His beloved flock through my words. When preparing my sermons, I listen to no one but Him. He condemns homosexuality, those who practice it, and those who support it. It's in the Bible, which I suggest you spend more time reading. And you can stop wasting your time worrying about me and my church. Surely you have enough on your plate in Pine Grove. I shall preach whatever I choose. Send in the federal government. With God on my side, I have nothing to fear. Praise be to Him, Brother Ted." Chapter 32. By noon Friday, Barry Reinhardt had propped up his poll numbers to the point where he felt confident enough to call Mr. Trudeau. Fisk was 7 points ahead and seemed to have regained momentum. Barry had no qualms about rounding the numbers up a bit to make the great man feel better. He'd been lying all week anyway. Mr. Trudeau would never know they had almost blown a 16-point lead. "We're up by 10 points," Barry said confidently from his hotel suite. "Then it's over? I know of no election in which the front runner has dropped 10 points over the last weekend. And with all the money we're spending on media, I think we're gaining." "Nice job, Barry," Carl said and closed his phone. As Wall Street waited for the news that Crane Chemical would file for bankruptcy, Carl Trudeau purchased 5 million shares of the company's stock in a private transaction. The seller was a fund manager who handled the retirement portfolio of the Public Employees of Minnesota. Carl had been stalking the stock for months, and the manager was finally convinced